Roosevelt's New Deal remade America, and millions want a Green New Deal to do it again.
All great American programs, everything from the Great Society to the New Deal, started with a vision for our future.
And to get to the first New Deal took massive strikes. I think we're seeing the beginning of that realization.
It's a watermelon. Green on the outside, deep, deep red communist on the inside.
Roosevelt himself never had any interest in challenging basic elements of a capitalist economy.
Interest groups who are allied with fossil fuels are kind of driving a wedge between what the public wants on climate change and what our politicians and their staff think that the public wants.
I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists.
There's more coming up after this.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is the sound of Foley Square in downtown Manhattan Friday, not far from our offices, the epicenter of a worldwide climate strike led improbably, perhaps, but solidly by millions of students.
We want change! We want change! We want change!
The 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who sailed across the Atlantic to ramp up pressure ahead of the United Nations Climate Action Summit, took the lead in the last week, testifying before Congress and rallying young activists.
I'm urging all of you to take part in the global climate strikes on September 20th and 27th. And just one last thing, see you on the streets.
In the U.S., the strikers are arrayed in support of a House resolution introduced in February by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey, known by most as the Green New Deal, or as Speaker Nancy Pelosi dubbed it last year, the Green Dream or whatever, to which AOC replied,
"No, I think it is a Green Dream. It is. It is. And I think that all great American programs, everything from the Great Society to the New Deal, started with a vision for our future."
Like FDR's wide-ranging government response to the Great Depression called the New Deal, the Green New Deal also puts employment and economic equality front and center. There are other echoes of the 30s as well in the form of collective action. Depression-era sit-down strikes are mirrored by the youth-led Sunrise Movement, which organized a sit-in at Pelosi's office, demanding democratic debate and action.
If you don't know what Sunrise is, we are building an army of young people to stop the climate crisis and create millions of good jobs for our generation in the process. Yeah! Yeah, that's what we're here to do.
That's Varshini Prakash, Sunrise co-founder, at a conference called Designing the Green New Deal held in Philadelphia last week. But wait, why jobs?
The way in which the jobs versus environment fight has been set up largely by elites who tend to have no skin in the game and are the ones profiting off of that has been hurting us for decades.
And so this hour, we'll be addressing how the issues of climate change and economic inequality, once seen as distinct and even in conflict, have, for this generation, come to overlap. And the response reverberates with the echoes of economic injustice of a time long ago, but never gone. In recent years, strikes have seen a resurgence.
Public schools across the state of West Virginia are closed again today as a massive teacher strike enters day 9, making it the longest in the state's history.
In 2018, teacher strikes spread across half a dozen states. And then?
Thousands of Marriott workers are on strike in San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, and other cities across the country. The workers say they're demanding livable wages so they don't have to work several jobs to pay the bills.
As I read this, another is on the horizon of hospital and medical workers.
Union organizers have said that as many as 80,000 Kaiser employees nationwide could go on strike in October if a deal isn't reached soon.
And at GM, contract negotiations have already broken down.
Jobs! Security!
Union auto workers started gathering around midnight at this Detroit General Motors plant and others like it across the country.
We want to be paid fairly. We make quality cars and we want quality pay.
The strike comes after GM's 2015 labor deal with the union expired Saturday over fault lines ranging from wages to health care coverage.
We stood up for GM when they needed us. We deserve a fair contract because we've helped make this company what it is.
At the height of the Great Recession, GM got an $11 billion bailout. Everyone seemed to be taking their lumps to save the company. Workers negotiated a contract that allowed for a two-tier system. New workers would earn less than the older ones for the same work. After GM brought in record profits last year, the time of shared sacrifice would appear to be over.
Tonight, all work has stopped at more than 50 General Motors factories and warehouses. More than 48,000 workers are on strike. That's the first against GM in 12 years.
Like they did this week, during a previous period of depressed labor conditions, GM workers left the assembly line.
What observers describe as the most crucial battle in American labor history, involving nearly 100,000 men, has practically shut down the entire American motor industry.
Anger swelled well into the Roosevelt administration, and over a year after workers around the country had earned the right to collectively bargain.
Lamar's, Iowa, storm center of the farmers' revolt, is under martial law as National Guardsmen seek the ringleaders of the mob that took Judge Bradley from this courthouse and threatened to hang him unless he swore he would sign no more mortgage foreclosures.
Now, here's where the existential parallels between then and now are manifest. It wasn't just that American farmers were poor. Their demands on the land had made the once great plains poor, too. The land, hatchmarked by railways and homesteads, denuded by deep plowing of native grasslands, had turned the topsoil into black, billowing clouds of dust. And so 5 years into the Great Depression, as historian Jill Lepore has written, quote, farm families displaced by debt and drought wandered westward, carrying what they could in dust-covered jalopies. The experiment in democracy that had begun with American independence seemed on the very edge of defeat. But in March 1933, a new president offered remedies for what ailed the nation, symptom by symptom.
In May 1933, a new chapter was written in American public policy. An act was passed creating the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. Their method was to control nature not by defying her, as in the wasteful past, but by understanding her and harnessing her in the service of humanity.
Vital to the communities which they serve are the thousands of miles of highways constructed and improved by the Works Program.
To address worker unrest came the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, and before it, the National Labor Relations Act.
By this act, employers are bound to bargain collectively with an organized majority of their workers.
And here's another potential link from the past to the present, the increasingly effective call to collective action. Because, though conventional wisdom says that Roosevelt bestowed workers with a voice as yet another New Deal remedy, an elixir from the Oval Office, Jane McAlevey, writer and longtime labor organizer, explains that that's not how it happened.
Yeah, no, that's a little upside down. When American workers won the National Labor Relations Act, that was because in 1933 and 1934, in the beginning of 1935, American workers waged extraordinary mini general strikes all over the United States to put the kind of pressure on FDR to give American workers the right to pull up as legal equals to the bargaining table with their employers. That was not given on high from FDR. In fact, a lot of the profound changes during the civil rights movement happened for the same reason. We have the tapes that show President Johnson on the phone with Martin Luther King.
On that, and I'm going to do my best to get other men to do likewise, and I'll have to have y'all's help. I never needed more than I do now.
Well, you know you have it, and just feel free to call on us for anything.
You better go create a lot of holy hell down there in the South so that I have the ability to do it. That's exactly what was happening in the 1930s in the New Deal. When FDR took over, he did a bunch of other things that were urgent and important. The Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration. I mean, there's a very long list of things that happened in the first 100 days. The National Labor Relations Act was not in the first 100 days. It was 1935 in the summer, 2 years into it, right? And it happened as a result of workers standing up for themselves and creating a crisis through massive strikes.
But in the years since the New Deal, we've seen labor decline in prominence. I mean, starting with the Taft-Hartley Act, right, in 1947, which restricted the activities and the power of the unions. You have right-to-work laws, which undermine the very structure of the unions. So why are we seeing all these strikes now?
I think you're seeing the strikes now because we are at the same level of grotesque income inequality that we were in during the Great Depression. You had 25% of America unemployed in 1932. What's similar and different in 2018 when the strikes began, in 2019 and heading into 2020 in this crucial year, is that we definitely have 25% as an index of misery. It's that corporations are more sophisticated today. So it's not rampant unemployment. It's rampant underemployment. White American workers transformed in the auto plants in 1936 and 1937 by walking out in massive strikes were conditions that look a lot like the average Amazon warehouse job today, where workers are paid substandard wages, don't get bathroom breaks. Workers are working two jobs, two and a half jobs, just to keep up and try and pay the bills. And that level of frustration is hitting a wall in this country right now.
I have to ask you, though, again, why strikes, given the state of the unions? In fact, you've noted that the word strike itself is on the rise.
Yeah. The strike that really began all of the strikes we're seeing was, in some ways, the very bold action taken by the teachers in Chicago in 2012, the first really big strike in decades.
Negotiations with public school officials now entering a second day. Mayor Rahm Emanuel saying teachers are making the wrong choice to strike, with 350,000 students paying the ultimate price.
And that strike kind of reawakened a lot of people. It began to do what organizers call raising the expectations of American workers, in that case teachers, that they could fight and win and demand more. And they did in Chicago.
Many people at the time were talking about how they were overpaid, spoiled brats, and so on. And yet the public did seem to stand with them.
When we were talking about what happened from Taft-Hartley until now, Ronald Reagan comes in, essentially fires 12,000 striking workers in the early 1980s to let Americans know, you go on strike, you're going to get fired.
They are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
And that really brings down strike activity for the next 25 years or so. There had been this narrative for 30 years that the public wouldn't stand with people when they went on strike and got fired. So when the Chicago strike happened and you saw the outpouring of support, it began to re-raise workers' expectations that, hey, even though they feel really beaten down, they actually have a lot of public support. And when you fast forward to West Virginia, they were the first ones to walk out in this new era of all the strikes we're seeing. When I interviewed a lot of those workers, one, they had met the Chicago teachers. They actually went to find them and seek them out. And two, the place where a lot of them met was the 2016 Sanders campaign. And if you look in West Virginia, he won every single county. And a lot of these young teachers, when Trump won, said to themselves, wait a minute, we built an amazing movement. What are we going to do now? And then right at that moment, the state legislature in West Virginia announced that they were going to take huge cuts. They were going to have to pay $200 to $400 more per month for their health care, and they were going to get a 1% raise. And they said, that's it. We're out of here. And they began to do real grassroots organizing work, teacher to teacher, bus driver to teacher. And when they walked out it was everyone. I mean, they were drawing on the history of the United Mine Workers. They were drawing on a proud working class tradition in West Virginia. But they have now set ablaze the whole country, a string of workers walking off the job and winning in the education sector, then against the Marriott hotels, then against Stop and Shop this spring, enabled the General Motors workers to say, forget it.
What makes an action a victorious action? And how would activists apply it to get the public into the street over climate change policy?
What does it take in this moment to tackle the largest crisis there is? The most important weapon that workers have is the ability to withdraw their labor and walk off the job. Strategic disruption in strategic sectors, in strategic geographies. And by the way, where the General Motors workers are going on strike is basically a map of the electoral swing states. We've got to get the American working class into and embracing the Green New Deal. And the way to do that is to guarantee not just a good job. There's a different set of words we have to use. Mm-hmm. We have to specifically say to the American worker, you will hold the exact standard that you have working in the fossil fuel sector right now in the clean economy sector. And to do that, we've got to flip the American taxpayer subsidies currently going to the fossil fuel industry to subsidize the jobs and the livelihoods of workers in a clean economy. And we've got to talk about that really honestly and then build the power to shift those subsidies.
Does the movement have to address the issue that strikes and this redistribution of wealth and these huge government programs are fundamentally anti-capitalist?
Right. If we turn on, you know, Fox News.
The Green New Deal, it's a watermelon. Green on the outside, deep, deep red communist on the inside.
You hear the same language that we heard during McCarthy period already. But what we need to keep focused on is what is it we're trying to do? We're trying to create a new deal. And to get to the first new deal took massive strikes. To get to a new deal so that life on this planet can continue and flourish means we're going to need a second wave of massive strikes. And I think we're seeing the beginning of that realization. Part of why I'm entering this debate is because I spent my first 10 years as an organizer running environmental campaigns. Hmm. And then I shifted into the trade union movement full time. And I've long said to people, a reflection of the problem in the American progressive movement is that I, as an organizer, am either working for the environmental movement or I'm working for trade unions, and the Green New Deal is the time to say these are not two different movements. For American workers' children to grow up in a healthy environment in this country, it's going to take American workers walking off the job the way we did in 1933 and 1934 and 1935 and forcing employers to the negotiating table to create a different kind of an economy in this country.
Jane, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
Jane McAlevey is a fellow at the University of California at Berkeley's Labor Center and author of A Collective Bargain, Unions Organizing and the Fight for Democracy, due out in January.
Coming up, the politics of the deal, new and newer.
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We think of the New Deal in historical terms, a monument of federal action almost universally understood to have rescued America from the Great Depression. What the textbooks seldom dwell on is the national politics of the day, pitting the supporters of FDR against Wall Street, big business, conservatives, far-right religious figures, naked anti-Semites, and those generally wary of creeping socialism as a prelude to communist totalitarianism. And it got ugly in very familiar ways. Kim Phillips Fine is a historian at NYU and author of Invisible Hands, The Businessman's Crusade Against the New Deal. Kim, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
As you look back at the contemporaneous arguments against the deal, you have isolated two main themes. What were those two basic accusations about what the New Deal would wreak upon our society?
So one line of argument against various parts of the New Deal is that it represented a step towards totalitarianism and dictatorship, that Roosevelt was setting himself up as a tyrant and was going to trounce the Constitution and was going to nationalize property and was going to end capitalism and bring in a very controlled economy going forward. So this is one line of argument that you see coming from organizations like the American Liberty League, for example, which was a group of business leaders who got together in 1934 to start to kind of mount both legal challenges to the New Deal and also to campaign publicly against it. The other is a sense that it wasn't going to be effective, that the New Deal wasn't ending the Depression, that it was naive, ill thought out, badly planned. Instead of seeing it as this masterly power grab, it's seeing it as kind of incompetent, foolish, and ineffective.
Those arguments have an eerily familiar ring to them in the context of the Green New Deal. There was one commentator who did this broadside against the deal based on the fact that Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez is an unmarried, childless barmaid and therefore is no person to entrust with this kind of responsibility. But then, you know, in other commentary, there's also the subject of totalitarian-level federal overreach. You've written that the New Deal was, in its essence, an emergency rescue operation to save capitalism from itself. I think that was your phrase, which in hindsight makes perfect sense. But really, knowing what we know about American politics, is it any wonder that the capitalists didn't want the government to barge into its free markets and inject the public sector into private enterprise? Of course they said it was a path to totalitarianism.
I think it's actually just important to remember both how severe the crisis was in 1932 when Roosevelt was elected. Unemployment was almost at a quarter of the population, much higher in many cities. Thousands of banks were failing. It wasn't just that there was an ideological attack on structures of property or capitalism. There was actually a real question about what was going to happen to the economy and how it could recover. And I think this is part of why many business people were so anxious about the New Deal.
So not necessarily fear-mongering. It was actual fear.
I think it was actual fear. Roosevelt himself never had any interest in challenging basic elements of a capitalist economy. But he was willing, and the circumstances were such that it was possible to do things that actually did change the balance of power in economic life in pretty profound ways. And I think just as it shouldn't be surprising that parts of the New Deal met with fierce resistance, so too parts of the Green New Deal are likely to meet with fierce resistance. And the question is whether there will be political movements, leaders, mobilizations that are capable of countering that.
Now, I scarcely need to tell you this because this is like the whole Phillips Fine deal. But the history of federal regulation of business is the history of these sky is falling predictions about job loss and recession and so on. Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, auto safety, OSHA, Obamacare, minimum wage, you name it, all were going to tilt the playing field and ruin our economy. Did these arguments, which, by the way, as far as I can tell, have never been borne out by reality. Did they begin in the 30s, or was there a precedent for them even then?
No, arguments have been circulating around since the late 19th century. People like William Graham Sumner and Andrew Carnegie were arguing that the efforts to use government will wind up hurting ordinary people rather than helping them inadvertently, and you should just let the market do its work. But I think they get a new charge in the 30s. And in a way, the 30s are the first time that there is someone in Washington who builds a political career himself out of responding to and inspiring this political impulse to find some way to even the economic playing field.
Let's look at one of the pieces of legislation just to get a notion of what specifically the criticisms were.
Mm-hmm.
One of the early targets was in 1933, the Securities Act, which tried to create some sort of protections for investors. What was the policy exactly, and what were the dire warnings that came from Wall Street?
The effort was to mandate that any company that was issuing public securities had to publish and make available a range of information to investors. This was happening in the wake of the stock market crash of 1929 and fraudulent reports that companies had been circulating about themselves. So it was basically trying to mandate that any company that was going to be selling stock had to release honest information about its financial situation. The next year saw the creation of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was charged with regulating and guaranteeing this. And the response from Wall Street was outraged terror, a sense that this simple request for information was reaching into the boardroom in ways that were heavy-handed and controlling on the one hand, and then also that it was going to frighten investors away. And so it would actually be responsible for prolonging the depression. The law in 1934 wound up quelling a lot of this, partly because the first head of the SEC was Joseph Kennedy, who was viewed as one of the Wall Street community and not somebody who was going to be, you know, hostile force. So at that point, a lot of the resistance really died down.
How did Roosevelt and the Democrats answer the charges of creeping Stalinism and Jewish overlords and the rest?
Roosevelt himself was always very insistent that what he was doing was in the interests of all Americans, that it was not intended to subvert democratic institutions but to preserve them, that he was just bringing forward the promise of the country into a new era. I mean, the New Deal actually also involved the active participation of many people across the country and kind of touched and transformed people's lives, either through direct relief from the state or through the employment that it offered or through the ways in which it transformed communities that saw new public works being built and the artistic creations that were funded by the federal government during the New Deal. All of these things actually gave people a sense of the New Deal being something that wasn't just imposed on them from outside, but actually something that they were helping to build. Also, the organization of unions during the New Deal was another way in which people actually actively had a sense of participating in building a new kind of social and economic order.
Kim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kim Phillips Fine is a historian at New York University and author of Invisible Hands, The Businessman's Crusade Against the New Deal.
Coming up, when it comes to climate change, research finds that Congress doesn't get what Gen Z wants, or what Gen X wants, or what the boomers want either.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. NYU historian Kim Phillips Fine told me that one of the ways President Roosevelt built support for the New Deal was by speaking directly to the American people through a nascent, highly intimate medium called radio. His cozy broadcasts were called fireside chats.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. To talk with the comparative...
He was quite charismatic in his sort of avuncular way on the radio. Is it naive and simplistic to suggest that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Instagram account is the new fireside chat?
What Roosevelt was doing was trying to create a sort of personal relationship, solidarity. And I think she's doing something similar.
I think this new generation is very profound and very strong and very brave because they're actually willing to go to the streets. How about that?
How about that? A recent study by the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication found that young people are more concerned than their elders on the subject and are more likely to contact a government official about global warming. And why are millennials and Gen Z taking up the cause so actively? Well, like the 60s protesters who agitated against the Vietnam War, they are most at risk.
and it will get worse. And so I think that is why so many young people especially care about this.
16-year-old Greta Thunberg from Sweden. In the past 4 years, Thunberg, who has mild autism, has helped drive this youth climate movement. She's repeatedly called out world leaders for their climate inaction.
And she is not alone.
My name is Issa Hersey, and I'm a climate justice activist in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I want to change how climate activism is viewed today.
That is Isra Hersey, another 16-year-old and the daughter of Democratic Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Hersey brings not only her DNA to the movement, but a particular experience and point of view.
It's a lot to be a Black young person in the environmental movement only because the spaces that I'm in and the organizations that I work with don't necessarily reflect me.
Hersey founded the U.S. Youth Climate Strike in January, which, like the Zero Hour and Sunrise movements, have enjoyed a high profile on major digital platforms and legacy media, which not only expands the reach of their messages, but also validates them for older generations. But in a sort of climate code switching, they're also fixtures in social media, where the idiom is very, very different.
Hey, fellow humans, listen up, because on September 20th, some stuff's about to go down.
Look, we have one more chance to turn climate change around, because in less than 10 years, the damage we're doing to our planet will become irreversible.
Wait, what?
On Instagram, teen influencers teamed up to encourage millions of followers to join in Friday's strikes.
Strike for our oceans.
Strike for our forests.
And strike for each other, because we have a very short amount of time to turn this crisis around.
If you're fed up and know we deserve better, on September 20th,
strike with us!
Other Instagram accounts like Climeme Change, with 44,000 followers, joke ironically about the end of life on Earth, share GIF-filled primers on the Green New Deal, and throw shade on the complacent.
Hosh darn it, gotta do everything yourself around here, picking up humans' trash. Let me show them how it's done here. One, two, in the doomahickey.
Getting involved, says The Intercept's Kate Aronoff, has become fashionable. With some degree of amazement and confusion, she's been following a meme called VSCO, that's V-S-C-O, girls, a suddenly emerging stratum of middle and high schoolers who affect a very particular look to project common cause with the planet.
The line between who the cool kids are and like what a VSCO girl is in 2019 is a thin line. It's sort of an aesthetic. They wear, you know, Birkenstocks, Crocs and socks, puka shell necklaces, oversized t-shirts, metal straws are a part of it. There's an affinity for turtles, hydro flasks, these reusable water bottles. There's a latent kind of environmental consciousness in it.
It's a bit of a fad, a bit of whimsy, and a bit of earnestness.
And the name comes from an app, a photo editing app called VSCO. But it exists on different platforms, Instagram, a little bit on Twitter.
One of them is TikTok. If Twitter is a mini blog, TikTok is sort of a mini YouTube. They're very short user-generated videos. One TikTok video has been shared a gajillion times.
Hi, you must be new. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a new hydro flask. Oh, you don't have one? How do you make your friendship bracelets then? That's kind of weird. Well, save the turtles. Oh, these? These are just my scrunchies. I noticed you don't have one. You keep that. Don't even worry about it. Can I use any?
In terms of like VSCO girls on TikTok, there's this like incredible amount of self-awareness about the fact that this is very silly. Everyone seems to be sort of making fun and just making these videos.
So I'm like really into saving the turtles lately. So I got a metal straw. You don't have one?
I'll have the acai bowl and a boxed water, please. And your straws aren't made of plastic, are they?
I think it would be easy to compare this to Valley Girls from the 1980s. And there is temptation in a misogynist society to treat young women as stupid. The VSCO girls phenomenon can bleed into that. I also think part of that masks over some very real things that are affecting young people. People who identify themselves as VSCO girls who I've talked to have said VSCO girls is a trend. It really is reflective of the fact that young people in general are concerned about the climate crisis. The folks I talk to, they are organizing for the climate strike and, you know, are themselves teens. They see this more than anything as kind of an organizing opportunity.
A movement hasn't really fully coalesced until a large number of stakeholders have embraced it. It's easy to have fun with the notion of a little meme and this kind of odd collection of participants. Is it evidence that climate activism has gone beyond the sort of usual suspects? Does this mean it's gone mainstream?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Folks that I talk to, they've said, when I was a freshman in high school, for instance, this is someone who just graduated, I was trying to do activism and it was a strange thing to do. Activism was not popular. Whereas now, after Donald Trump, after Parkland, you have VSCO coming out and being a part of the movement the way that many, many other people are. All sections joining up in the climate fight, activism is becoming cool. Young people are more active and mobilized than maybe any other generation in history. Just yesterday, speaking in congressional testimony, the head of the Zero Hour, this youth climate movement that is participating in the strike.
People call my generation Generation Z, as if we are the last generation. But we are not. We are refusing to be the last letter in the alphabet. I am here before the whole country today, announcing that we are instead Generation GND. The generation of the Green New Deal. The only thing that will save us is a whole new era.
It was pretty dark and a pretty stunning way to think about your future. And part of what this youth climate movement is really about is giving people a space for community and not to feel just hopeless about the potential end of the world.
Kate Aronoff writes for The Intercept and is a fellow at the Type Media Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So even the cool kids want to be involved in climate activism. Or maybe climate activism is redefining what it means to be cool. In the halls of Congress and in many newsrooms, there are other less existential concerns, and they fill the political ether with mixed and misleading messages. Leah Stokes is a professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where she studies public opinion and political behavior with a focus on energy and climate change. Last year, she co-authored a study that told us what you might have already suspected. Congress has no clue what Americans want.
So these are the chiefs of staff and legislative directors in Congress, the people who help their bosses decide how to vote on a bill. And we asked them, what do you think the public wants on climate action? And they dramatically underestimated the public support that's out there for acting on the climate crisis.
92% of the staff members that you surveyed underestimated the support in their district or state, including all Republican aides and over 85% of the Democratic aides.
And we actually show the more those offices are meeting with the American Petroleum Institute, which is the Association of Fossil Fuel Companies, and the more they're taking money from them relative to meeting with, let's say, environmental groups like the Sierra Club, the worse job they do at guessing public opinion. So it seems like interest groups who are allied with fossil fuels are kind of driving a wedge between what the public wants on climate change and what our politicians and their staff think that the public wants. Research done by the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, which I am affiliated with, they make these maps and they look at all these different policy areas and show what the public wants. And the media has had a narrative, and politicians have had this narrative too, that the public doesn't really care about climate change. It's not really an important issue. And if you just go look at these amazing maps, you can see that that's just not true. Mm-hmm. So, for example, they've just put out a new map about the proportion of people who think that fossil fuel companies should have to pay for the harms that they are already causing. 57% of Americans, a majority of Americans, support that. And then you can actually zoom into every single congressional district and figure out, for example, across Arizona, a relatively conservative state, people support that. Across New Mexico, they do.
Why do you think the public feels this way in the absence of support from their politicians and their media?
Support for climate action has been high for a long time, but in the past 9 months, we've seen a huge surge. Something like 10 percentage points more people are worried about this. This reflects a number of things. First, last fall, we had the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, report come out, which really showed that we have to make dramatic strides to cut our emissions.
And I think that's very sobering, but stuff that the UN does never seems to make much of a dent on the mainstream American public.
I would agree, but somehow this report broke through.
There is a new report out about climate change, and it is not positive.
And I think actually journalists had a role in that. Somebody picked up that report and framed it around, we have 12 years left.
The world has just 12 years to stop a climate change catastrophe.
So that gives us 12 years to make sure that the temperature doesn't
increase. A little more than a decade to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide released into the
world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. And your biggest issue is your biggest issue is how are we going to pay for it?
12 years is not a long period of time.
That's not in the report. That was a media decision. And then the Sunrise Movement picked it up. And a lot of scientists actually have gotten very upset about the 12-year framing. But from a media and communication perspective, it's genius because
it
gives people...
We
have 11 years to cut emissions by about half. That is what the report says.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is true that there is a clock ticking and we've already warmed the planet by 1 degree Celsius. And if we want to reduce it or limit it to 1.5 degrees Celsius, there's a timeline. Of course, if we don't meet that target, it's not like the world explodes on the first day of 2031. And then the other thing I would say that has begun to break through is climate impacts are actually happening.
California is burning on both ends, decimating an entire town called Paradise.
Coverage of the damage caused by Michael, the Category 4 storm, was the most powerful hurricane on record to hit Florida's panhandle.
Imelda first striking Freeport, Texas. Some areas could see upwards of 18 inches of rain.
And the media has not done a great job of linking people's lived experiences to climate change, but that is starting to catch hold.
For a long time, scientists said that it wasn't wise to attribute the cause of any particular weather event to climate change. Weather was too complex for that. Attribution science, as it's called, has gotten a lot better, right? It's now possible to connect the dots between some instances of extreme weather and climate change.
Public Citizen, this NGO, wrote a report that showed that only 1 in 5 articles that talk about heat waves even mention climate change at all. Heat waves are the most easy to attribute to climate change. Every time I open up an article, I look for climate and I look for global warming, and I usually come up empty-handed.
Leah, why do you think that is? Is it still regarded as a political issue and it's a question of perceived balance?
Climate change is actually the most polarized public policy issue in the United States because of the denial campaign that the fossil fuel industry has run for over 40 years. And journalists, they don't want to make mistakes. And I really value that. But that's making them kind of fearful about linking things to climate change that really should be linked. Mm-hmm. I have been working on a project with a student, Emily Williams, and with the website Climate Signals to try to take the science that is being published in academic journals, often behind paywalls, and get open access versions so that journalists can easily find the article that shows empirically that, yes, you can link this event to climate change.
I was really struck by this study this month from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, and it said 7 in 10 registered Iowa voters support government action to address climate change. 77% of Iowa voters are more likely to support candidates who favor increased funding for renewables.
That's a really consistent finding over the past 6 months, showing that primary voters are going to vote based on this issue. And there were several polls coming out a few months ago that said it was the number one issue, even above health care and immigration. And let's not forget, we have the climate denier in chief in the White House.
Just announcing that he's revoking California's power to set its own vehicle emission standards.
California reached a deal with 4 automakers in July to reduce emissions by 3.7% every year.
Well, feds are going after the car makers that signed a deal with California on emission standards.
I think him rolling back environmental policies has woken up a lot of people to the consequences.
But it sounds like what you're suggesting is that the biggest mind changer is lived experience. Even if those congressional aides who find themselves surrounded by the arguments of lobbyists might have a change of heart if they had a personal experience of extreme weather.
The research so far is showing that when people believe in climate change and they experience extreme weather, they become more active. So right now, that's Democrats and maybe some young Republicans. But if you don't think climate change is real and happening, then you're not going to connect the extreme weather back to action on the part of the government.
So we don't know for sure that lived experience will do it, but one of our producers found a story in Harper's earlier this year with an anecdote that I just loved. It was about the environmental legacy of the New Deal, and the head of the Soil Conservation Service, a man named Big Hugh Bennett, he was preparing to testify before the Congress on the need for a new agency, and then he got wind of a dust storm that was headed to Washington, and he stalled his conclusion until the storm arrived. Here's the quote from Harper's. As he finished, the congressman rushed to the windows of the Capitol, watching as the duster rolled in like a vast steel town pall, thick and repulsive. The skies took on a copper color. The sun went into hiding. The air became heavy with grit. This, gentlemen, is what I'm talking about, Bennett told them. There goes Oklahoma.
I love it. Well, we had a nice moment like that with the CNN climate town hall because Hurricane Dorian was bearing down on the country.
We're seeing firsthand the effects of climate change as a powerful Atlantic hurricane is sitting right now off the coast of Florida. It could make landfall tomorrow in South Carolina. Tonight, Democratic and independent voters will be asking the questions live here in our audience and also by video.
What do you think of the coverage of the various climate proposals from the candidates?
Let's just go through one of the issues in these plans. How fast do you want to hit net zero emissions? Elizabeth Warren says, I can do it by 2030. 2045 is the target for Cory Booker, Julian Castro, and Kamala Harris. 2049 is Andrew Yang's number. 2050 is what Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg says. Are there voters out there who are going to say, aha, I'm for Warren because she gets there quicker?
Yeah,
or is it just you have to have a plan?
Many journalists call me up and they say, oh, look, all these plans are the same. If you contrast the Sanders plan with Warren's plan, which was based off of Jay Inslee's plan when he was in the race, what we're actually talking about is Sanders takes nuclear off the table. He says, we're not going to use that and we're going to have 100% renewable energy by 2030. Warren, by contrast, says, we're going to keep stuff on the table and we're going to have 100% clean energy by 2035. Let's be clear that these are both really Herculean goals. And Biden's goal, by contrast, is by 2050, so a lot further in the future. Actually, Bernie Sanders' plan is 50% harder on an annual basis than Elizabeth Warren's plan.
What do you mean harder?
I mean that you must be deploying new technology at a rate that is 50% higher every single year. And just to be clear, the Warren plan says that we're going to deploy at 17 times current deployment rates. Bernie Sanders' plan is we're going to deploy at 25 times current deployment rates. So both of them are ramping things up on a huge scale. And I think the media doesn't understand that these words on paper that have technologies that are eligible, that have targets and timetables, would really change the landscape of America in a different way.
Before you go, Leah, could you read a quote that you brought to our attention from Thomas Edison?
Yes, this is from over 100 years ago. And he said, the scheme of combustion to get power makes me sick to think of. It is so wasteful. You see, we should utilize natural forces and thus get all of our power. Sunshine is a form of energy, and the winds and the tides are manifestation of energy. Do we use them? Oh, no. We burn up wood and coal as renters burn up the front fence for fuel. We live like squatters, not as if we owned the property.
How'd you feel when you came upon that?
I felt that we have lost so much time to denial campaigns from the fossil fuel industry, and we must start to turn the tide, and the fossil fuel era must end.
Leah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Leah Stokes of the University of California at Santa Barbara. Her upcoming book is Short-Circuiting Policy, Interest Groups and the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy in the American States.
We're coming down to the ground. There's no better place to come. We got snow upon the mountains. We got rivers down below. We're coming down to the ground. We hear the birds sing in the trees. And the land will be looked after to send the seeds out in the dew.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg. Special thanks to Andy Lancet, Archives Czar at WNYC. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.